Before you listen to this podcast, you can subscribe to The Critic magazine with the current offer of 5 issues for just £10. Head to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk, to subscribe today.
Welcome to The Critic Podcast. I'm joined by writer, musician, and founder of Labour Beyond Cities, David Littlefair. David, welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
David has recently written a piece for us about Sunderland. So those of you who've been following the arts news may have heard the deputy head of RADA, the Royal Academy of Dramatic Arts, one Cynthia Erivo, was rather derogatory around Sunderland. I don't know, David, would you like to fill us in on how that went?
She was on a on an American talk show, and this kind of resurfaced around her appointment, sort of the day that she was announced as the deputy head. And she'd been on this American talk show talking about her touring experience in the UK. And she'd listed a set of some cities that were wonderful and some cities that weren't.
The less than wonderful places.
Yeah, less than wonderful.
The non-wonderful people live there.
Exactly. And so her sort of logic was, well, Manchester, some cities are wonderful, like Manchester, which is just like London, or Liverpool, where they have, and she sort of affected a Scouse accent. And then she moved on to single out Sunderland.
I've got the quote here, so I'll read it out. You go to Sunderland, and you're like, apologies to viewers here, there'll be strong language, where the fuck am I? I don't know where I am. This is not where I live at all.
Which is a good thing, I think. And that's why I sort of wanted to write that article in general, is I'm from Sunderland and I moved to London, and so I've got a pretty good experience of both the cities and the art scene in them both. And I thought it was worth talking a bit about what my experience growing up as a teenager there and putting gigs on and being involved in the art scene was like, by contrast to London. And also to talk about, you know, the things that I really like about the city. I'd seen some other responses written. Keenan Malick had written in The Guardian, for instance, an article that essentially the thrust of it was, well, don't worry, Sunderland isn't as racist as it was in the 70s.
Wow.
And the sort of general consensus was for broadsheet media to just pick up writers that had probably never been to Sunderland to write some kind of comment about it, because the video had gone viral. And I think, you know, the reasoning why the video had gone viral really was down to the fact that if you've been in the art scene in a small city or a small town outside of the sort of metropolitan hubs of Britain, you know, you've been in an uphill battle most of your life, and you've kind of had to deal with those kinds of attitudes, which is, you know, inherently sneery for, you know, the best part of your entire adult life. And it's a shame to think that organisations like RADA, that have so many sort of statements about how interested in social justice they are, would have the exact same really kind of patronising attitudes that you come across, not just in the arts, but everywhere if you've kind of been from the north of England.
Where do you think that hostility comes from? So obviously there's a whole kind of weird racial undertone to the whole thing, you know, like this place isn't quite diverse enough, it's not London, go home.
Yeah, well, I mean, I don't doubt in... There's a really odd sort of mythic idea of what the North is like for people who aren't white to visit, and it doesn't really chime with my experience, but it isn't Sunderland's not a very diverse city. It's about 98% white British or white other. And it wasn't the norm when I was young. I don't think there was one mixed race child at my secondary school, and that was basically my only kind of contact with anybody who wasn't white growing up. And I think, you know, that there might have been issues in the past, but I think I don't remember there being, for instance, racist bullying at my school. There might well have been, and it's not, I didn't want, when I was writing that, I didn't want to think, I'm here to talk on behalf of Cynthia's experience of visiting Sunderland as a person who wasn't white. But I was sort of thinking, I'd hate for that to be an attitude based entirely on presumption, yeah, and not an effort.
I mean, the thing I'm sort of struck by about this is the sort of the sense of kind of like a tale of two Englands, because you've got here, you know, this person who just cannot, you know, you've got these two completely different sort of Englands demographically, economically, culturally, and the thing is, I want to say there's mutual misunderstanding, but I don't think it is mutual. I don't think people from the north, from places like Sunderland, struggle to understand what's going on in London because it's broadcast all over the media every day.
Mm.
Whereas I think it does feel like a one-way direction of travel. I mean, is that what you found?
Yeah, I wouldn't expect anybody to know anything about Sunderland. If they weren't interested in football, they wouldn't really know anything about the city, really. There hasn't been maybe there's one or two people. I mean, just in the context of arts, there's a singer, Sam Fender, who's actually incredibly famous now, who might be sort of representative of the city on the sort of popular culture level, although he's not actually from Sunderland and he is a Newcastle fan. So there's a but there's a complete lack of purchase in the sort of popular consciousness of cities like the one I grew up in, and I think there's an entirely untold story around those cities and around what the last two generations have looked like within them that's been imposed, and a lot of that has sort of been centrally imposed from London with really patronising stereotypes.
We're going to get deeper into this, but one thing I'm interested in is this idea that, you know, there are sort of cities you go to and then there are cities you come from. And I feel like, you know, the places that she names as, you know, wonderful, you know, London, Manchester, they're places people go to, and the place she doesn't like, Sunderland, is the place people come from. And I'm saying this because, of course, David, you're from Sunderland and you've come to London. So I'm really interested in, you know, and this comes up in the piece, what that looks like. So, you know, what was it like growing up in Sunderland? You know, what formed you culturally as an artist, as a thinker, as a writer? You know, and how did you end up here and not there?
Yeah, that's a really large question. I think, well, one of the things, first of all, that I wanted to sort of put into that article that I didn't think was in some of the other sort of broadsheet responses were that Sunderland is a great place to live and a great place to grow up. And it's got an incredible coastline. It's got some high technology and car industry jobs that are incredibly stable compared to other parts of the country and really, really socially valuable. And its arts and culture scene is really good, but it's a very do-it-yourself one. And so when I grew up there, there wasn't really, I'd imagine it's different now, and it's definitely different in London, because I moved to London, met people who grew up there, but there wasn't really any expectation that you would ever do anything in terms of the arts and culture when I was at school. We had some guitar lessons for a little while, but there was nothing sort of, right, well, this is what you do if you want to be in the arts. That wasn't a thing at my school. It wasn't a thing at my college. And there was no local figureheads, certainly left in my generation, or in the generation above, that could give you the sort of path in that respect. So I started putting on gigs at my college just because I was a massive music fan, and it just seemed like a thing that you could do, which I guess when you're a young teenager, it's, you know, things just occur to you and you just give them a try, and there's no real sense that you have to know anything to do them. So we put on some that were at the Washington Arts Centre, which is around the corner from where I used to go to college, and we put on some at the school hall. We got banned from the Washington Arts Centre because somebody kicked in one of the urinals in one of the first gigs we did.
That's got a rock and roll artist story energy.
It's about as rock and roll as I've ever gotten, really. So I peaked very young in that respect. But we did those. They sold out. I remember people turning up with fake printouts that they'd made at home of the tickets we'd been selling at school. And so we kind of got to university. I didn't move away for university. I went to Newcastle, and so did my friend. And he said, "Oh, we could carry on doing this." And when I'd been at Farringdon, the comp that I went to, there were some lads in the year above who were in a band called This in Vegas, And they used to hire out a cricket pitch in the sort of city centre and put bands from around the country on there. Which, you know, looking back, the fact that teenagers do that or did that then, I'm not sure Zoomers have quite picked the torch up quite so much, but I still look back and think it's really impressive and really precocious. And we got into doing the same thing essentially. So we used to run nights in pubs around Sunderland. One was in a what was, before we started putting on gigs there, a strip club, but it had a function room in the upstairs with a PA. So we used to put bands on there. We'd start booking bands from around the world as well. So we were bringing bands from Los Angeles, bands from Sweden, bands from France up to Sunderland, to, you know, relatively small audiences, and using our sort of student loan and Saturday jobs to fund the inevitable losses.
You're doing this all yourself. Are you getting any? Is there any money anyone's giving? Is the university helping? Is local government? Are there resources you use?
I think that's what I thought was really worth kind of going into some detail about in that article, because everybody that I'd met through the music scene in Sunderland especially, but generally in the northeast at the time, there was never any expectation that there'd be an institution that would come in to give you any help or anything like that. Now that I'm pushing 40, I realise that you can ask for the Arts Council for money for things like this. But that was never an understood thing when I was younger, and there was never any expectation that it would be. And so it was very much one of these things where it was like, well, this is a losing battle. And but if we don't do it, there's not going to be anything to do in our city.
Yeah, because, I mean, I was... not to pull things off track, but... I mean, I don't know if you noticed... I mean, it got blocked in the end, but there was this group in Northern Ireland called Kneecap.
Kneecap, yeah.
Yeah, and they're rappers who were... I mean, until, I think... I can't remember, was it Gove or something, stopped it. They were going to get Arts Council funding for, you know, I mean, I don't know, people who aren't familiar, it's basically kind of IRA-themed rap music. It's all kind of, you know, F the Queen, you know, very, it's like, you know, a sort of edgy Queen with less imagination.
Yeah, okay.
Sorry, that's some old culture references.
Yeah. What do I think about them getting blocked from taking the art?
Yeah, because I'm interested in that, because they get money, obviously. They're not a British region exactly, but, you know, they're in Northern Ireland. But I mean, is it like they're just separate ecosystems? Like, are there groups out in Sunderland, out in the North East, getting this money that you didn't? Because they know the system, or because they know someone, or, you know, they just think to apply for it.
I can't think of how we would have ever gotten any money when we were young. Because they're just, like you say, there was nobody to tell us about it. And I didn't realise until I moved to London the vast plethora of jobs that people have in the creative industries, because there's very, very few creative industries jobs in the North East in general, and especially so in Sunderland.
So the thing is, you've got this passion, you're doing this very entrepreneurial work, you're still at university, and you get out of university, and I think it's around, what, it's around 2008?
Late 2007, 2008.
Yeah. So, you know, obviously the banking crisis comes in, and what's the next step? Did you try to get into the music industry? Do you try to make it into a job?
Well, I think by the time I'd gotten into sort of my early 20s, I sort of really solidified this attitude of not really wanting to be in the mainstream music business, because of the people that I'd met through it.
Well,
it put me off it quite a lot, and I wanted to do something that felt a little bit more meaningful. So
yeah,
I was putting gigs on right up until the banking crisis, and I'd managed to when you were a student in 2007, you could just go into the university basement and speak to a stall with one of a number of banks at it and take out a free overdraft. So I had 3 maxed out overdrafts at the end of 2007. And then the banking crisis hit, and I lost my job. I was in...
You're working for the charitable sector?
Straight after university, I worked for a web startup.
So you're working for a web startup, yeah.
And I used to put the gigs on around that. And then when that kind of came to an end, I was I spent the next sort of 3 or 4 years just bouncing around the UK trying to find any kind of work at all, really.
You see, you know, of course, but no one would be exactly surprised that music industry, not easy to get into, not easy to make a career out of. But I think the more surprising thing is you go off into other work, you've got a good degree, you're clearly very capable, and yet you're not able to find something that's right.
In the period after the banking crisis, the youth unemployment rate in the northeast of England was something like 35%. And most of the jobs that people I knew who had managed to hold on to a job were in call centres. And I guess I got out of... I mean, I wouldn't have the same attitude nowadays, but I definitely got out of university with a chip on my shoulder about working in a call centre, because that had felt like the reason I went to university was to not end up doing that. but recessions have a way of kind of rubbing you of those personal delusions. And I ended up doing all kinds of things. I worked in a place in Houghton Spring that did a kind of text to speech recognition for BBC archive videos for a bit. I worked for DFDS Seaways, which is like a holiday cruise ship controller that goes between Sunderland and Amsterdam and does stag nights. I worked there for a transport employer in Manchester. It was all kinds of different little odd jobs.
So how did you end up in London in the end?
I gave up thinking, I'd moved back from Manchester thinking, okay, well, the recession is supposedly over now, so things will get better. And I was in my mid-20s, and I really hadn't managed to establish an adult life at all. Mm-hmm. So I was still on sort of 3-month contracts. And it was a case of, well, if I'm going to get work now, I guess I'm going to have to move to London, because there seems to be no other choice. And I was also going out with somebody, and my young person's rail card ran out, and it was like, well,
that's a dark day in life.
I can't justify the long distance anymore. I mean, the main thing that changed was the fact that I got to London, and it was like all of the people that I knocked about with there just hadn't had the same they hadn't been bouncing around trying to find work for the past few years the way most of my mates had. And they'd landed jobs in think tanks and things like that.
Because I'm used to hearing London tales of woe in the form of how the hell do I rent somewhere larger than a cupboard, let alone buy somewhere kind of variety. What kind of monstrous commute am I going to work out so I can start a family? Mm. I mean, have you found that an issue? But do you feel like the trade-offs were... I mean, you know, we all want to work that trade-off out, but, you know.
I could talk at length about the ups and downs of living in London, but I think most people have probably heard that done to death at this point.
We know we're off, we speed there.
But I did move into working in the arts in London. And I think that's probably the other thing that I think is kind of interesting about the... you know, the motivations behind doing an article like that is the arts sector in London is incredibly classist in general. And I was sort of involved. I used to work 4 days out of five, and then I'd sort of notionally on a Friday I'd try and do something in the arts, and I'd go to kind of meetings of various different people, and then I'd get harangued. Sometimes it'd go like this. That's a very privileged male thing to say, you know, from somebody who was in the arts. And then you talk about, within about 20 minutes, you'd find out that their sort of inherited property potential gains in life are about 6 times my family's.
Yeah, it's not the first time I've heard that, sorry. Let's put it that way.
So there's a lot of like particularly received attitudes in the arts that make it a bit difficult to be a bloke from the northeast in London to some extent, but I don't want to whinge on about it. But the main thing I think that makes the difference is that you know that as a sector it sees itself as incredibly radical, but it's incredibly rare to meet somebody who doesn't have either a high earning partner. Or a massive whopping inheritance or something. And so it's a very, it's a sector that kind of, that wants to see itself as really radical, but on a materialistic basis, I'd say it's incredibly exclusive. And I feel like some of the attitudes that are projected from that towards places like the Northeast and whatnot are almost like a sluice for the kind of liberal guilt that arises in that situation. A sluice for the cognitive dissonance that arises when you see yourself as really radical, but everybody around you is posh.
Yeah, so, and the Arts Council, I mean, it's worth saying, I think it isn't, what, like a third of its funding goes to London?
Yeah, I'm not entirely sure what the most recent settlement is, and I'm a massive Nadine Dorries fan, which is, in the circles I move, quite a controversial opinion. But Nadine Dorries is basically the only person in my entire lifetime who actually made any real effort to get money out of London and into different parts of the country.
Yeah, and what do you make of the, I mean, I don't know if you followed it, like the English National Opera's moving to Manchester. I mean, you think that's a good move?
Well, I think there's already an opera company in the north of England.
I mean Opera North. Yeah. Do you mean?
But the up until the last Arts Council funding round, 70% of the Arts Council spending on music went on opera, which is a very elite art form, in my opinion.
Although again, it's a bit of a self-fulfilling prophecy, given the ticket prices. It's like a lot of sort of high culture. It sort of survives by subsidy, but it's also very expensive.
Yeah.
Which, you know, it's unfortunate because, I mean, you know, we're big defenders of opera here. We have a dedicated opera correspondent who you can hear on other podcasts. Mm. But I think also that it's striking. If you go to Italy, if you go to Latin America, it is a popular art form.
Yeah.
You know, it's not rock and roll, it's not pop music, but it's, you know, you get ordinary lower middle class people go with their families.
Yeah.
It happens outside, it happens on a big scale, it's seen as part of people's national culture in a big way. Mm. Like, for whatever reason, you know, Britain has its great, you know, we've got Benjamin Britten, we've got some incredible composers, and both for opera and for classical form, but it's just the consciousness of it as a popular art form is just gone. I mean, it may not be your era, but I'm just wondering if you had a view on all that.
I'm very much a Philistine when it comes to opera.
So.
I think there's probably a way of mischaracterizing that kind of argument that's like, oh, well, you think that the pleb shouldn't have access to opera or something like that, which I more say it like this, is that the Arts Council hasn't had its funding uprated in the way that it could cover all the different bases that it potentially could.
Yeah.
And so some cuts would have to fall to equalise the funding formula. Yeah. And they happen to fall on an elite art form with a high amount of cash amongst the kind of people who programme and decide what culture receives money in Britain. And so there is a sort of uproar about just how aggressive the terms were. And I'm not saying it was a great decision or the best formulated decision, but I do think it's an interesting thing to think about, that this kicking off occurred because the opera was being somewhat defunded in a context of it dominating funding for decades.
Yeah, so, you're obviously very angry about excuse you saying, like, you're very calm, but like, I can see the sense of, like, you know, the place you grow up, you know, neglected, kicked off to the side, ignored for funding. I mean, to play devil's advocate, though, you know, London is produced, you know, outside, I think if you look at the British regions, I think outside of London, southeast and the east of England, everywhere else is, I think, a net recipient of funding. I mean, now maybe arts funding isn't shared out evenly, but when you look at who's raising tax revenues, you know, it's London, and there's much more of that money's being transferred than is coming back in.
Yeah.
So I mean, you know, if I was an obnoxious London elitist, I might say, well, why should you have lots of cultural spending?
Which is a really common argument. I don't think I think you'd have to be very deluded to to try and challenge the idea that London drags the entire British economy forward with it, and that most, you know, most regions and most people live off subsidies that are generated in London. But also, I mean, that's kind of a quirk of history. The region I'm from, the report that that we discussed earlier on, that came out in 2023, that Ed Balls authored with Harvard University, talks about the rate of deindustrialisation in regions in the North and the West Midlands especially, as being significantly faster than the equivalent in Germany or Italy or Spain. And the result of that is, you know, those countries' industrial bases reduced by, I don't know, I'm pulling figures off the top of my head here, but something like 15-20%, and in terms of the amount of employment in those sectors. And ours went down by sort of 40-50%. Places like the West Midlands and the North East have basically never recovered. So there was a strategic forfeiting of a possible future where the regions might have less of a dependence on London. And so I think there's a, you know, there obviously these kinds of funds are generated in London, but I think there's a real moral question there about you know, about whether or not you can hold some future generations as sort of enthralled to a decision made previously that they weren't really party to. And it's not, I wouldn't necessarily say anybody in those areas voted or wanted
to. So you feel like deindustrialisation was a political decision that was made in London, and now the decision to concentrate on things like art funding is equally a political choice?
I definitely think there's a mirror there. I mean, when the Arts Council was funded, I mentioned this in the article. There is an idea of the Arts Council that I think you'd really, really struggle to recognise nowadays, where it wasn't supposed to be prescriptive about what you could say or what you could do within the arts, which is in the context of Kneecap, who you mentioned before. Now, I've not heard Kneecap's music, and it's probably not my thing. But I would argue maybe the sort of Irish Republican sympathies might not have really passed muster at the time. But the general idea of the Arts Council when it was founded was to, it wasn't to gag people. And it was to have a set of regional identities in England, Wales, and Scotland and Northern Ireland that were really distinctive. And you can't really have that without money. You can't. The arts do cost things, and I think that's the thing is. So without that money, the reliance has been on people like me and the people I grew up around to basically create the culture out of a sort of high idealistic martyrdom towards a form which I would argue people like Cynthia or Eva probably never had to experience. They've probably never had to go to bat for a losing cause like that.
Yeah, and I mean, I'm interested in this idea of like this tension between diversity, you know, meaning racial, sexual, whatever, versus regional diversity, you know. And I think that's a huge tension in worldview, because I think if you live in London, your view is, well, you know, we're all here in this cosmopolitan centre, we need our identities represented, that's how we're going to have, you know. And they try and take on the questions of, like, regional identity, but I think it's just, like, it's about class identity or regional identity, and I think the idea it's about place is where they struggle. And I think they sort of seem to think, well, shouldn't... And it does feel like there's, whether intentionally or not, a homogenising drive.
Yeah, definitely. I think some of that is just about the sort of bureaucratic processes that you have in terms of trying to get money off the Arts Council. Yeah. And their strategic outlooks kind of create a sort of implied way of doing art that is, I would say, much more sort of the vision of the, you know, London board member type class than it is.
Let's try to kind of colour in some of the blanks here for people. And what would you say sort of comprises the kind of cultural output, something like, you know, London and the Arts Council? I mean, what do you think that looks like, and how does that differ from, you know, what you feel would like be coming out organically from, you know, British Region, places like the North East.
Well, look who's on the board of the Arts Council and who decides who gets the money. One of the board members is either a current or ex-chief executive of CH Gateshead, so that's the really big North East kind of contemporary arts venue, a little bit like the Barbican. And that one building took, I can't remember the figure, but it's mind-blowing. It's like half of all of the funding in the North East just went to that one building for the best part of 10 years or something like that. And so somebody who was in this sort of chief executive class who, you know, wanted to see a kind of incredibly accomplished sort of elite architectural feat in the North East, just turned it into a kind of black hole that sucked up every little bit of funding. And I would argue that there's a real bias towards bricks and mortar and not towards people. And the North East's culture has always come from, you know, the people and the kind of...
Sort of funding galleries rather than artists, as it were.
Pardon?
Sort of funding galleries rather than artists.
Yeah, and... Yeah, exactly. Or massive contemporary music buildings and not musicians. And I think some of that is changing, but it does... That's how that sort of executive mindset works, I imagine. It's like, well, we'll have a really large building and that'll generate culture. But what actually happens is that it's sort of, I feel like a kind of
so that's a sort of administrative difference,
yeah.
You know, that but I'm just more mean like I'm, you know, it's also about what kind of culture gets funded. And I'm just sort of, I'm trying to get sort of like, what's distinct here? What's the kind of distinctive difference? So like, you know, turn it on where you grew up on Sunderland, you know, I know it's very hard to define a culture in a few words, but like, what do you feel was distinctive about it? Like, what did it have to offer that you wouldn't find in London or not in the same way?
Well, Sunderland has a really particular sort of political history and an industrial history. Mm. That is really linked to kind of organised industrial labour, and hard labour in, you know, mines and coal faces and things like that. So a lot of, and brass bands, and I mean those kinds of things don't really exist in London. And that whole culture of old mining communities were very self-reliant and had friendly societies equivalent and medical societies and things like that and their own brass bands and various other things, and so they were, I would argue, they're very self-organizing and they had their own particular idea of what a valuable life and what valuable culture looked like, and obviously those industries and those jobs are dead and gone, but I think the principles were incredibly kind of decentralized and democratic. And I would, you know, the Arts Council doesn't really, in Sunderland it pumps money into like quite large sort of culture agglomerative administrative bodies that are, you know, like a trust essentially that'll kind of oversee everything else. And so, you know, it's kind of hand money to bureaucrats.
Yeah, one thing I was very struck by in your article was you talk about the original intention of the Arts Council, and you have this great quote from the economist Keynes, who says, "Let every part of Merry England be merry in its own way," and also declaring death to Hollywood, which was a great line. And I do think there's a real sense in which London's now become a kind of signal booster for basically a kind of globalised, Americanised culture. So, you know, you mentioned things like, you know, very kind of things like, you know, mining communities, sort of local industry, landscapes, history. And I think a lot of that gets washed out with this when it comes to sort of contemporary art. I mean, it's very conceptual above everything else. I don't know how often you darken the doors of modern art galleries, but, you know, it's not just abstract, it's conceptual. It's very, you know... You can go to an art gallery in New York or London, you know, or Berlin, And, you know, if it's a Monaghan gallery, you'll see something very similar.
Hmm. I think that's a good point. I think probably that the trend there is towards kind of internationalism in terms of the subjects that people might think are worth making something creative about in general. I would say, you know, places like Sunderland are probably seen as having their sort of best days and days of cultural influence being pretty far behind them, and that what's remaining isn't really a especially sort of sexy cause.
Yeah, see, I mean, on that, I mean, obviously, it's a big question, so I don't necessarily expect you to have an answer, but, I mean, do you see a future for places like Sunderland? So, you know, is it just like coming with the begging bowl for like an extra bit of funding, or do you think that there's some sort of new settlement that could, you know, at least give some kind of revival? I mean, if it's not going back to its industrial history, what's the next step?
Well, the benefit of a place like Sunderland is that it's cheap to live in compared to other places, and that used to be, you know, that used to be the precursor to any kind of artistic sort of outflow and settling in of people who wanted to live kind of creative lives.
Yeah.
Was that they'd find places that were cheap to live. And the North East really does have a sort of really thriving grassroots art scene, much more so than when I was a kid.
So your argument isn't so much, you know, you'd want sort of the Arts Council to come in and, you know, astroturf a kind of generation of sort of Arts Council handpicked artists. It's much more, you just want a bit of fuel and fertilizer for something that's already there that just needs what it needs to expand and accelerate and stabilize.
Absolutely. And I think the whole thing about Death to Hollywood is that it's really difficult for any arts organisation nowadays or funder to sort of conceive of success that doesn't look like, oh, we're basically Hollywood.
Yeah.
And that's been a theme that's run through, you know, most of my life working in the arts in the Northeast. Is we had a regional development agency for popular music called Generator, which is still going. And the general sort of feeling that you would get from Generator was that if they can just fish out one person that becomes like a superstar, that's how they've done their job. And there's a real sort of, I think there's a feeling that unless you're a sort of success and you make a lot of money, which very, very, very few people do in anything creative nowadays, that what you've done isn't really successful or isn't really meaningful. Which is, again, that's the thing about, I think the thing that's interesting about the history of the North East and arts there is, I don't think the Pittman painters, for instance, were ever sort of especially professionally successful artists.
Yeah, I mean, that's one thing I'm interested in. It's sort of this really quite recent expectation that good art is commercially successful art.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I think that's, and I wonder whether that's an artifact of really quite a brief window of mass production when, you know, if you could make a really well good selling record or something, you could, you know, suddenly you could become, you know, you could become this massively successful person. But now I wonder whether the sort of dial's heading back in the other direction, where, you know, people who are successful artists outside of a few very small number of people, they're good at having a relationship with their fans.
Yeah.
Effectively, their fans are basically their patrons.
Mm.
You know, they're giving money to support them, listen to their podcasts as well as their music, they're going to the live venues.
I mean, my industry that I know about is popular music, and I would say that has been, I mean, even people talk about this as if it's a recent phenomenon, but I would say even since I was a student, most of sort of British popular music has just been an avenue for people who are already incredibly wealthy. And that's, you know, that is a big failure of the British art system, I guess, in general. If it can't seem to create opportunity outside of a sort of dynastic view of art as something that gets passed down as an opportunity between the landed gentry and their kids, it's, you know, that definitely is not what the Arts Council was originally. But I remember years ago I was on a tour managing job with an American songwriter called Daniel Johnson, and his tour support was Laura Marling, and at the time she was sort of going out with the singer Mumford and Sons or whatnot. And the British Council was paying for them to tour India. And I made some kind of comment at the end of the tour where we were sort of asking, what are you doing next? She said, oh, well, the British Council's paying for us to, me and Mumford and Sons to go and tour India. And I'd said something along the lines of, oh, that's very British Empire. And that went down incredibly badly, but that was my sort of brush with, oh yeah, this is, you know, this is the arts world for people who've been within the sort of families who have created this modern generation of artists, and they're all, you know, the children of sort of multi-millionaires now, and that's quite a bad thing.
Yeah, I mean it's interesting because in a way it sort of, we've sort of come back full circle. Like, you know, arts and culture and music are things that historically were dependent on patrons. You know, they happen, you know, we think of big concert halls and things, but that was a development of civic government. You know, before that, it was chamber music, you know, and it was church music. The idea, it's always taken government funding to bring that, to bring, you know, musical culture to a really large scale. And I do wonder if that's what's now missing.
I would say the impression that I get from government funders nowadays is the government's kind of given up on ever trying to understand what good art is,
yeah,
or what useful art is, really. And instead it's created a set of characteristics of people that it wants to encourage to be involved in art.
Yeah, because I'm interested in this, and again, is this another one of those questions which, like, if you don't ever meet an answer, I would understand. I mean, if people aren't, if we're relying on Arts Council to fund culture, how do they do that? Like, how you know, they are perforce but in a position of judging art. So, you know, who should be doing that? How should they be doing that?
Well, I mean, depending on how familiar you are with this, it has a set of national portfolio organisations that sort of chop and change.
Yeah.
And then it has a kind of pot of money with certain priorities attached that are called, that under the name of sort of project grants, which individuals can apply for. And recently it started to do something that I think is a really, really important, totally unexplored avenue, which is these grants under the name Developing Your Creative Practice, which are just that you apply for a grant to be able to do something creative for a while, which I would like to see a lot more of and a lot less go to massive institutions.
Yeah. So more for individual artists, and also, I mean, I would think from your experience, you know, people just don't know they can apply for it.
Yeah.
And they're not in institutions where they're given the training and the education and the connections to even begin.
It's not just that, it's the fact that writing the applications is a mind bender. I mean,
yeah,
it's not a skill that everybody would have, and I wouldn't expect.
I want to have exactly. One of the reasons I didn't go into academia was I didn't want to have to spend the rest of my life doing grant applications.
Yeah, well, I do a lot of those, and I do think though that, I mean, that's where also the Arts Council now is much more concerned with sort of therapeutic type applications, yeah, of art, and that's sort of become something that I've seen much more and more over the years, which is you kind of have to come up with a medical justification for why you do creative things, rather than it just being an innate part of human nature. You have to sort of go, well, if 100 people were surveyed after this and 59% of them said that they felt 5 points better and 40% of them said that they felt 4 points better. And it's a little bit like statisticians run far too many things nowadays.
Price of everything, the value of nothing.
Yeah, and but also it's not even about the sort of bean counting that is attached to so much of this stuff. It's about knowing the mores to receive the beans. So
I mean, I do feel like a lot of this is about sort of, you know, having to justify the spending. So, yeah, you know, you're putting however many hundreds of millions into culture, but what is culture and why are you funding it? And, you know, the kind of least controversial answer is this somehow grows the economy, this somehow makes people happier, healthier, wealthier. I mean, if it's not for that, what is it for?
I recently saw Keir Starmer tweet that he was going to put more music lessons in the schools because when he learned to play the guitar or something like that, it also helped him in other more commercially viable ways or something, which I know is it like, you know, there's a lot of people will be convinced by that argument, but I think it's a pretty dark argument to have.
But again, I mean, I'm enough of I mean, you and I are both men of the left. I, however, am on the reactionary end of socialism. So my view of pop culture is pretty much we do this because it's something we have done and thus ought to do, and it's good to do it. Like, I don't think it needs a downstream justification beyond it being beautiful and part of a tradition about who makes us who we are. So you know, we should perform plays because Shakespeare's the thing. We should learn Shakespeare because people would have been learning Shakespeare for centuries. I know that sounds a bit self-fulfilling, but it's, you know, there's a sort of sense in which, you know, a continuity of culture and experience and language allows us to form a moral and political community. It gives us an ability to express ourselves that deepens. So the longer someone does something for, the more they're able to understand their history, the more they're able to understand themselves, the kind of greater their range and depth of expression. And I think that's now very hard to achieve, and I think it's very hard to achieve, especially in places like London, because you know, it's become this very diverse sense, not only in the literal sense of lots of people coming here, but also in the sense that it's a city very driven by individualism. People come here to make money. They come here to define themselves. They don't necessarily come here to find other people.
I would definitely say, I mean, so the old socialist tradition about access to the arts was sort of summed up in the song Bread and Roses.
Yeah.
And it was, oh God, I can't even try and recite it, but it's something like Heart Starve. No, I'm not going to be able to. But the general gist of it was that we're not just in it for material gain.
Yeah.
There's some element of, and I guess you get in a controversial territory when you start talking about the idea of having a soul that needs to be fed as well.
Workers of by hand and by brain.
Yeah. And so but I guess where it comes to London, I suppose, is that, like you say, only a certain kind of person is going to survive in the London meat grinder, and so they're either of a certain kind of outlook on life.
We are both either all the way or halfway in the meat grinder, as we both live and work around London. What is there anything you would? I mean, obviously there must be something good about it. There's got to be something in it, you know. It can't all be bad.
Well, I mean, there's a lot more
opportunity.
Yeah, there's a lot more opportunity, and I've definitely been inspired by the kind of work that people do around here. I think when you talk a bit about sort of homogenising forces and death to Hollywood, I definitely think that there are certain ways of approaching arts and culture in London that are relevant to London's multicultural milieu, but that aren't really relevant to the North East, in where I'm from, in quite the same way. And I suppose that means that if you're, you know, if that's your passion, is to do something that's under the sort of umbrella approach of kind of something that might be referred to as like decolonization or something like that, then this is the place where you need to be to do that kind of thing. But where that kind of thing filters through into the national art settlement, I would just say that it seems much less relevant to the place where I'm from. And there is something about, so I think the arts is sort of looked in a more therapeutic way, but there's also this kind of it's almost like a sort of there's this kind of Pygmalion idea about some kind of a way to use the arts to kind of make people better people and more kind of liberal minded. Which I find makes me feel really uncomfortable to think about, because I suppose when I was a kid, getting into the arts and music I did shaped my political outlook pretty profoundly. But I don't necessarily see art as a means to change someone's politics, and I feel like that's another way it's looked at as well.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like so much of the conversation, I introduced it sort of as a tale of two Englands, and I think the interesting question is, how do we live with each other and also inside each other's heads? Because we're one country in a world of sort of rapid communication and transport. We're very intimate in a way, like, you know, if someone says something in London, you hear about it. You know, we're talking about it now, and I just wonder, how do we make space for each other's Englands, as it were? So, like, you know, you mentioned, you know, people who have a very kind of relevant interest in the question of empire and decolonization, for them it's an urgent question about who they are. How do you resolve that in a way that includes bits of the country where it's 98% white and frankly their experience of empire was being quite possibly exploited quite a bit too? How do you reconcile those experiences? And a lot of people, you know, I know on the left will say, well, everyone should just be showing solidarity, you know, the working people are exploited because they're working class, people are exploited because they're black, you know, shouldn't everyone just be, you know, aren't migrants and working classes, shouldn't they all just join hands and sing God by art? But I think, as you pointed out, one can't help but notice that certain people are being asked to hold the hands of other people and not vice versa. So there's an awful lot of, you've got to come and, you know, in practice, the class and the region stuff doesn't ever seem to play out in the intersectional logic. And what do you think that is?
I think that's the sort of big question of our era for me, is why is there so much kind of focus on, I don't know, I don't want to talk down quite as much, but I can't think of a better... phrase than, why is there so much focus on things that are cosmetic in terms of racial background and sexuality and things like that, and so little on kind of class experience, is something that has, you know, baffled me for a long time. And I don't know how the UK, which I would argue is, like, you know, like you're alluding to, is still very much in the grip of what I would argue is much more sort of Americanized political outlook around these things, is it can put a foot forward in a way that says, you know, this is our identity. For me personally, the way that I want to do that kind of work in my own kind of life and my own sort of professional is to find those kinds of stories that are a lot more optimistic than a lot of the sort of I would argue it's very sort of race pessimistic American politics. And Britain is always, well, not always, but there are parts of British culture and British history that are really inspiring and very positive. And they can be multiracial. So for instance, in Sunderland, there was a migrant from the Caribbean who moved from Barbados, Charles Duncan O'Neill, and he was educated at Edinburgh University. He met Keir Hardie, the Labour Party founder there, moved to Sunderland and worked there as a doctor, and a good doctor, not the kind of doctor that used to rip people off before the NHS came in. He used to do surgery and treatment and whatnot to the local mining community for free. And he must have been probably the only black man in, if not Sunderland, probably the whole of the North East at the time. And he sort of had this idea of class solidarity that you were talking about before. And through that, he got elected to the miners elected him to the local council. And they gave him responsibility for the kind of local education authority. So he was figuring out how miners' kids were going to be educated, basically. And I think... For me personally, I don't know what the big national level strategic summary would be, and if I did, I'd probably be getting paid a lot more. But the stories that I,
or a lot less,
yeah, maybe. Well, the stories that I want to tell about Britain and about Sunderland are the optimistic ones.
Yeah.
They're not the ones that are sort of couched in, well, you know, the 70s, we had a sort of level of pride and dignity, and that's gone, and everything's tragic now, which is kind of a lot of kind of the outside view of the North East, definitely. But I want to sort of look at ways to merge that tradition that existed in industrial towns and cities, and in that's sort of part of that kind of English ideal that goes back through sort of Quakerism and whatnot. In a way that can be really optimistic about what people can do when they're brought together in a communal, with a sort of communalistic outlook, not necessarily an individualistic one, which, like you say, is that's the kind of person who battles through the membrane of the London arts community. They tend to be very, in my experience, tend to be very individualistic.
Yeah.
Whereas, you know, the sort of cultural community that I come from is much more communalistic, and those are the kinds of things that I like to get the opportunity to be involved in and to tell to other people.
Well, on that very optimistic note, on which we have some hope that the communitarianism of the British regions might yet come back and re-enchant bitter, disenchanted, individualistic London. David Littlefield, thank you so much for joining us.
Cheers, thanks so much for having me.
If you've enjoyed listening to this podcast, why not subscribe to have the magazine delivered to your door? Subscribe today with the current offer of 5 issues for £10 by heading to our website www.thecritic.co.uk.